Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have word about a freeway shooting on Highway 94 in Spring Valley, and the CHP is seeking your help to find the shooter. The City of Lemon Grove is holding a special meeting this week to consider censuring Councilwoman Leanna LeBaron. Find out why on today's show. And on our Capitol Report, hear about a vote in Congress to extend VA medical coverage for veterans exposed to toxins such as those in burn pits in the recent wars. Learn who voted for it and who voted against it on today's show. We'll also be re-airing our interview today with Joseph Rocha. He's a candidate running for the state legislature against Brian Jones. Then from Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines for you on the latest situation in the Ukraine, as well as protections granted for Ukrainian immigrants temporarily in the United States. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report. California Highway Patrol seeks public help to identify a freeway shooter. On Saturday morning, March 5th, around 9:40 a.m., a vehicle pulled up behind a white Ford Edge on Highway 94 westbound near Kenwood Drive exit in Spring Valley, then opened fire. The shots injured the woman driving the Ford, which crashed into the center median. Two male passengers in her vehicle called 911. The victim was taken to a hospital for treatment of injuries. According to Officer Travis Garrow with the CHP, the suspect vehicle fled west on 94. Anyone with information or may have witnessed this incident is asked to contact the CHP El Cajon office at 619-401-2000.
After weeks of contentious meetings, Lemon Grove's City Council is holding a special meeting on Tuesday, March 8th at 6 p.m. to consider a resolution for the council majority to condemn alleged misconduct by Councilmember Leanna LeBaron. The proposed censure resolution accuses LeBaron of disruptive, obstructive, and inappropriate behavior at council meetings, including shouting over colleagues and interrupting others when not recognized by the mayor. It also alleges that she made baseless accusations targeting staff, including fraud and hiding the truth about city finances, having a detrimental impact on the city's ability to attract and retain talented staff. The censure motion asks LeBaron to refrain from public attacks on city professionals and threatens that the city might fail to indemnify her if an aggrieved employee or former worker were to file an action against her. The city attorney has also sent a letter to LeBaron and other council members threatening legal action against her. The city attorney's letter accuses LeBaron of unauthorized use of a conference room at City Hall, disrupting staff, and ignoring a prior request to cease these actions. The letter claims this exposes the city to potential liability due to employee claims. Now, the letter further states that access codes to City Hall for all council members are being revoked as a result. The city attorney asked LeBaron to cease such actions, adding, "If you refuse, the city council will proceed to seek a court order to restrain your behavior." LeBaron has denied wrongdoing. On Facebook, she told constituents that the council's aim is to, quote, "punish me for the work I do on your behalf." She posted the resolution along with a letter from City Attorney Kristen Stank on March 3rd, which she says contains false accusations. She encouraged her supporters to attend Tuesday's meeting. LeBaron has been persistent in seeking questions on finances and procedures, at times talking over others when the mayor would not recognize her and others would not respond. But multiple council members have complained that disruptions by LeBaron have delayed meetings and impeded council's ability to get anything done. A recent council meeting was adjourned early as a result of LeBaron demanding an answer to a question on procedures for groups to gain access to the rec center. Concerns have been raised by all four of the other council members, including members of multiple political parties. Councilman Jerry Jones says lack of decorum, bullying, and shouting over every member of the council has become the norm for LeBaron. He objects not to her questions, he says, but to what he calls her combative and disrespectful style. He adds that some of her questions would be better to ask during goal setting and budget development sessions, adding, "This is why she gets no response from the rest of us." Councilman George Gastel also encouraged residents to attend the meeting. In his email, he states, "Ms. LeBaron often says she was elected to serve the people. All five of us were elected by the people, and I have to say four of us are serious about serving the people. The people did not elect Ms. LeBaron so that she could disrupt meetings, harass staff, and swear at her fellow council members. That is not serving anyone, and that is what needs to stop," Gastel concludes. The fracas has drawn the attention of prominent attorney Corey Briggs, who contacted our media outlet to inform us that he's representing Project for Open Government. That's a nonprofit, and that he's requesting records to determine whether Lemon Grove officials can back up their serious claims. The nonprofit Project for Open Government has a mission statement to ensure that unethical and illegal conduct by government and those doing business with government is exposed and appropriate remedies are pursued. The group recently filed a lawsuit against the County of San Diego over alleged free speech and open government violations. Briggs had strong words for Lemon Grove's efforts to discredit LeBaron, which he suggests are efforts to undermine her re-election in 2024. According to Briggs, Councilmember LeBaron is doing exactly what her constituents sent her to do: ask tough questions, tell the truth, make sure the public truly benefits, and hold officials accountable for their misdeeds. That was her platform. She got the most votes in her elections, and she is delivering. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
On his website, Congressman Daryl Issa calls himself a proud veteran who served as a U.S. Army captain. But the Republican representing portions of San Diego and East County recently voted against H.R. 3967, a bill to make Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans eligible for VA medical coverage of conditions due to toxic exposures, such as those released in burn pits. The Honoring Our Pact, PACT, or Promise to Address Comprehensive Toxics Act, passed the House of Representatives by a 256-174 vote. The yes votes included 222 Democrats and 45 Republicans. San Diego has many military veterans, and our region's other four representatives, all Democrats, voted in favor of the measure: Sarah Jacobs, Mike Levin, Scott Peters, and Juan Vargas. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America issued a press release praising House passage of the measure and urge senators to also approve the bill, which President Joe Biden has indicated he will sign. The veterans group states, "This legislation will help the many thousands of veterans suffering from military toxic exposures, such as burn pits, who have inadequate access to VA benefits. It is comprehensive legislation that will address the needs of veterans that are suffering from basic toxic exposures by ensuring that they have the health care and benefits that they deserve. Failure to pass the bill would result in a gaping self-inflicted wound to continue to kill those who served their country," says the organization's CEO, Jeremy Butler. Burn pits were used to incinerate and burn waste, hazardous material, and chemical compounds at military sites throughout Iraq and Afghanistan. A 2020 member survey of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America found that 86% of respondents were exposed to burn pits or other toxins, CNN reports. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Now, if you're listening to our show today, streaming live over the internet, you may not be aware that an ice storm has caused major damage to the transmitter atop Monument Peak near Mount Laguna, and so the station is currently unable to air over the radio airways. Your donations are needed to help get KNSJ back on the air across San Diego's East County, and you can donate at knsj.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. And today, my very special guest is Joseph Rocha, a candidate running for the newly redrawn 40th State Senate District seat, which currently is held by Brian Jones. Joseph is a military veteran. He's served in both the Navy and the Marine Corps, working as a bomb dog handler, tracking down explosives in the Persian Gulf. I guess he's got the courage to be a politician now. And later, after obtaining his law degree, as a Marine Corps captain and prosecutor. His testimony was instrumental in the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. And now Joseph says he's committed to justice for everyone. Full disclosure, Joseph also served as an intern here at East County Magazine way back in 2008, interviewing candidates for Congress and local offices, and now he's running for one himself. He announced last year, actually, that he would run for Congress, but instead he has set his sights on the state legislature due to the redistricting. He says he's running to focus on jobs, housing, infrastructure, veterans, and climate change, among other important issues. So, Joseph, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Miriam, it's so wonderful to see you again. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're all real proud of everything you've accomplished since you left here. So let's start by talking about how the 40th State Senate District has changed with the redistricting. Can you tell us what communities are now included in it? And after that, what path for victory you envision here?
Yeah, absolutely. So our district, you know, to give you the visual, we start up north in Rainbow and we make our way down north in East County. We cover Fallbrook, Escondido, San Marcos, Poway, Ramona. We make our way down to Alpine Valley. And then what's thrown this district into the competitive realm is that it took a hard swing out to the coast all the way to University City. So we nearly reached UCSD's main campus just on the other side of the 5 freeway.
Wow. So that's a lot of new territory that Brian Jones has not represented before. It does still include here in East County, folks, the areas of Alpine, as he mentioned, Pine Valley, Mount Laguna, but then it snakes north. So it no longer includes places like, you know, El Cajon or a lot of the meat of the district. So it sounds like it's going to be a very interesting race.
That's right, Miriam. So just for reference, Brian won this district by only 3 points 4 years ago.
Wow.
And that was in a Biden plus one. In what would now be a Biden plus one, in what would have been a Republican registration advantage of 3 to 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
The new district that he's drawn into, I like to say, is not the district that elected into office 4 years ago, in that it's a Biden plus six. And it has nearly erased the Republican registration advantage. So if at all, it is at 0.06, not even a full percent.
Very interesting. So it's basically evenly divided among the two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Fascinating.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit more about your background, your ties to the district, and how you think your experiences have qualified and prepared you to serve the people of this district in the state Senate, Joseph.
Yeah, so I had a very formative and challenging childhood that really led through into my career. But I'm very proud of. I think that the adversity in my life has given me the passion for justice and for service that I have today. So I'm second generation Mexican American. My family started in Northern California, just miles away from the capital, actually, in the fields and factories of Woodland and Davis. My mother raised me until I was seven. She was a grocery store worker, but she struggled with addiction and she lost me when I was seven. And then my father took me in Southern California, and I've been here ever since. You know, he raised a family of five, so his own two children and his wife and myself, with a truck driver's salary, which is nearly impossible nowadays.
Yeah.
So these you know, bread and butter, working family issues and the middle class have been a core passion of mine since I can remember. When I was 17, I had to leave the home because I came out as gay. And I actually survived by working as a dishwasher. I stayed in high school for my senior year. I graduated and I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy because I wanted to go to the Naval Academy to be a Marine Corps officer. I became a military police officer because they were being deployed in high numbers at the time. I became a bomb dog handler because to increase my opportunities or chances to be deployed. And I went to Bahrain to get to Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So I spent 2.5 years doing explosive detection in the Middle East. Wow. And then following being accepted to the Naval Academy Preparatory School, no less, I was discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As you mentioned, I was in the case. It's a federal court case, but a federal court case that was held here in Riverside, where I was a principal witness, and it ruled Don't Ask, Don't Tell unconstitutional. It was critical to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There had actually been a legislative vote prior to the ruling that had failed, and then it was put back up for a vote after, and obviously now having been ruled unconstitutional, it passed. For me, it was equally as important to be an example of positive out leadership as it was for us to be allowed to serve in the first place. So I went to law school, and in law school, I returned to the service. I commissioned as a Marine Corps officer. I served as a judge advocate. You know, a little bit about my Marine Corps bio. My first job was as the deputy legal assistance attorney for Mickey East, which is about 20,000 Marines. And legal assistance is basically your one-stop shop for all legal issues for the Marines.
Yeah, everything.
I like to equate it to constituent services, right? So one of the top jobs, most important jobs of a California state senator is constituent services, and it's connecting your constituents to the services of the state and helping lift them up. And I did that. I did that quite well. I actually earned the Legal Assistance Attorney of the Year award for 2019 and 2020 from the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Thank you. So from there, during the global shutdown, I was deployed to Central America. And I was the subject matter expert in embassy evacuations for the 7 embassies that were there in Central America during the global shutdown. So that's when we were still trying to move troops, but also be prepared in these more unstable countries. If any of them were to collapse, how we would ultimately have to move American citizens back to the U.S. And then finally, I did my prosecution stint doing serious and sensitive felony crimes in Marine Corps prosecution.
So you've really been in a lot of the world's hot spots and also got a lot of good legal experience, which can certainly come in handy when drafting laws. We see some where it looks like maybe someone should have had more legal experience on occasion.
Yeah, no kidding. I know some people, you know, I think we get a bad rap. I certainly think that, you know, there's probably no good use for, you know, high paid corporate lawyers in public service. But I think it should be distinguished that public servant lawyers are very necessary in lawmaking. You know, you wouldn't ask, you know, why there's an engineer on building a bridge, right? You would want an engineer to help you build a bridge. I think that public servant lawyers are important to good policy and lawmaking.
Yeah. Well, speaking of policy and lawmaking, let's talk about some of the issues in the race. What ideas do you have, Joseph, to make housing more available and more affordable for new home buyers as well as for renters? You've said this would be a priority for you.
Yeah. So I'm a lifelong renter, but I also did own a home in my last duty station in North Carolina in Camp Lejeune. So I feel like I've experienced both sides of this equation. I think it's equally important that we increase access to first-time home buyer ownership. We know that that is the path to generational wealth in America, right? Owning property. Mm-hmm. And there are many communities that not only have not had access, but have been actively removed from access or barriers have been in place so that they can't have access to mortgages. And, you know, I think that's the first place we need to start in helping get people all on the same footing. With that, you know, obviously, I think we still have to have renter protections. How building more housing is obviously key to getting out of this housing crisis, but we also have to make sure that we're not just giving a windfall to developers to gouge and run renters into the ground. You know, making
exactly while taking all the parking in the neighborhood. We hear these, you know, complaints from people sometimes, and it's a really big challenge because it seems like no matter where you put the housing, there's often community resistance or other problems. We just saw a judge tell the supervisors they had to undo a big housing development out in Otay because it was a high fire danger and they had failed to consider what this would mean, you know, for everybody trying to evacuate on that roadway. And then when they try to put it in urban areas with maybe a high rise and say a suburban area, then people think it takes away community character or parking. So it's really a really difficult, I think one of the difficult, most difficult challenges that legislators face. And yet we have this housing shortage. It's really a crisis. So many people, young people especially, just priced out of the market completely.
Absolutely. You know, there's no question that we are decades behind in our housing building. And but there's definitely an appetite. There's a lot of activism, social justice activism, and community leadership to get through this. And I think that every time we run into a barrier like the ones that you mentioned, those are just opportunities for us to factor those into our next project so that they can stick and be successful and increase the housing market. You know, and I obviously reducing red tape, which is heavy in Sacramento, is something that I'm very passionate about that would go a long way in solving most of our policy issues. And is something that I think as a Marine Corps officer, you know, I would be well equipped to do.
Very good. San Diego County has one of the highest homeless rates, if not the highest homeless rate in the entire nation. And it's only gotten worse with the pandemic, with more people losing their homes. What's your approach or approaches, since it sometimes is a multifaceted problem, to keeping people from losing their homes in the first place and then to helping those who are homeless get off the streets?
So I think that, you know, one thing is there needs to be better communication between all levels of government. So the state, the county and the city, so that we're not wasting money, right? Nothing's more frustrating to taxpayers than seeing money wasted. So a better communication between all levels of government. At the core of all of our issues is going to be housing. We're going to come back to housing quite a bit today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously addressing that housing crisis and shortage. A lot of people who are homeless because, you know, they just missed a mortgage payment or they missed a rental payment. You know, they got sick, they ran out of paid sick leaves, they live alone, they have a family. You know, these are compounding issues where, you know, good, hardworking Americans who have paid their bills and who had done everything right come on hard times and then suddenly find themselves first living in their cars and then living on the streets. So, you know, there's a level of compassion and empathy that needs to be had while I understand that the state is frustrated. And there's a level of action that needs to be had. Otherwise, the taxpayers are going to continue to be frustrated with us. I think that, you know, continuing to move these mobile teams in the direction of mobile teams where we are deploying, you know, healthcare services, mental health services, and drug addiction services, and connecting the homeless population to the services the state already provides that aren't being utilized to their full potential is important. And then lastly, just, I think we could do more. Too large a population of our homeless are veterans. And I think that there's more that we could do in the transition phase of our service members to civilian life that would prevent this.
That was my next question, actually, was as a veteran yourself, what role do you see the state having to make sure that veterans, especially those recently returning vets coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, many of them who had very long deployments, you know, that they're getting the resources and help that they need, not only the homeless vets, but the ones that may have other issues?
Yeah. This is something I'm really, that I feel very strongly about, and I love to talk about, which is, I think California needs to do more for our active duty service members. I think we need to build more rapport and better rapport with our service members. You know, I did serve on that joint deployment to Central America. So, and as a dog handler, we're trained by, and our classmates are from every service branch in Lackland. And so I've served with every branch of the military. And I'll tell you, the one thing that you know across all service branches is a service member from Texas will be the first to tell you that he's from Texas, right? And he'll be the first to tell you all the programs and all the benefits they get for being active duty in their state. And that's something that I think would go a long way in this state, especially as we see radicalization creeping up in this state and in our district. And as we see, more radicalization within the ranks and within our veteran community, if there was a stronger relationship with our active duty service members, it would go a long way. So quickly, I'll just give you some examples. One, in Texas, service members, they get free tuition. That allows them to give their spouses or their children their GI Bill, which means that that's creating generational wealth, right?
Good idea. That's kind of a federal issue. Or is this something that the state can do?
No, that's something Texas does. So Texas is giving their service members free tuition. And because the federal government already gives a service member their GI Bill, which is a full ride, they are able to roll over that GI Bill to a family member, an immediate family member. And so that helps that go a long way. We've seen here, particularly in San Diego, I think we have all been very alarmed and upset to find out how much food insecurity there is within the lower ranks of our service members. So, targeting as a state, the employment of spouses would go a long way in helping these families be able to provide for their families. And so just those little things, I think there's a long way that we can go in creating a little bit stronger of a relationship with our active duty service members.
Very good. You've mentioned you wanted to focus on creating good paying jobs and including here in the San Diego region. Can you elaborate a little bit on what your plan might include?
Yeah, so that's actually exactly where we left off. So there is a difference between employment and gainful employment, right? Yeah. So a person who has 2 to 3 jobs and never sees their family, has no paid sick leave, has no vacation days, has no healthcare benefits, is employed, but they're not gainfully employed.
Right. Flipping hamburgers and driving Uber is just not going to support a family in this economy.
So people should be able to have a single job that provides for their family. That would be a focus of mine in the state. I'm a strong supporter of unions, and I would be a champion for unions in the state. They built the middle class. My family obviously once made their way up to the middle class and enjoyed a middle class that was very different from the one that we have now, if at all.
Yeah, your dad was a trucker. Was he a Teamster?
My dad did. He was a member of the union when he was younger. And my mother was a grocery store worker. And then grandparents, farmers and factory workers. So, these were good, hard, honest jobs that could provide for a family and either hardly can or cannot anymore. And so we need to fix that. And the hollowing out of the middle class is also at the core of a lot of our woes in the state and at the federal, at a national level, right? As we see rich people get richer and working class families work themselves more into the ground with no light in sight, that creates frustration and it also divides us. So worker protections, rebuilding the middle class and looking out for those working class families, making sure that the opportunity that allowed me to be the first person to go to community college, law school. And while there's a history of service in my family, the first person to become an officer, that I want to make sure that opportunity exists for our next generation.
Yeah, those are very worthy goals. Infrastructure is another priority that you have listed on your website, Joseph. Our region has a lot of infrastructure needs, from obviously things like improving mass transit, ending the gridlock on Highway 52, but also protecting the public from, we're researching a story now on 2 aging dams, one at El Capitan, one at Lake Hodges, both of which are very near active earthquake faults that are capable of
that.
We had one right near there the other day, and it's capable of about a 7.8 quake. And these are both ranked as extremely dangerous by the state, both in terms of the condition of these old earthen dams that are crumbling away and how many people would die if they were ever to break. So given that backdrop, I would like to ask what you think should be priority projects for our region, and would you fight specifically to get some funding to start repairing these dams, especially El Capitan? I think there's a little bit of a plan in progress for Hodges now, but nothing on the horizon that I've heard of for El Capitan, which is the worst of all of them out here in Lakeside. But if it flooded, it would basically wipe out Mission Valley, you know, all the way down.
Yeah. So in the congressional run, I was a strong supporter of the infrastructure bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, no less. Mm-hmm. And that has obviously unlocked a tremendous amount of resources and funds to the states. And that will make its way down to the county and the city, but not if we don't fight for it, right? So mm-hmm. I would absolutely fight for resources for the district as hard as I've fought for everything else. And I, you know, I'd be a great advocate for the community up in Sacramento. As far as priorities go, you know, they're equal. I mean, it's as equally important for you to be able to get to your children and pick them up from school as it is to make sure that you, you know, your house doesn't get washed away. You know, something that as a Marine is very important to me is listening to experts and leaders. And so, again, back to that communication piece between the city, the county, and the state, you know, I'm sure they're getting engineering reports about all of these projects and which are pose a greater threat to the community, and those should be prioritized.
Okay, thank you. You've mentioned common sense solutions to tackle climate change. This is one area where I believe you and the incumbent, Brian Jones, probably differ sharply. At least some years ago when I interviewed him, he was a climate change denier, basically did not think it was real or did not think it was that man was contributing to it. I don't know if he's softened or changed on that through the years, but I would like to know what solutions you would support to tackle climate change and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And that said, without imposing undue burdens on those who can least afford it, an example being, for example, the proposed mileage tax, where a lot of the rural residents could be stuck paying $1,000 a year and yet not benefiting from the mass transit project. So it's another thorny issue, but obviously it's a global concern. What are the answers that you would support?
Yeah, so last I checked, I believe that Brian was rated 8% for his legislative record on the environment. He also prides himself on being a supporter of firefighters. You cannot be a climate change denier and be a supporter of firefighters. Our state is facing, you know, these increasingly dangerous and larger fires every single year. I was talking to a firefighter, an older firefighter leader recently, and he told me that, you know, when he was a kid, you almost wished that one day you could be a part of a big fire just to sort of cut your teeth and earn your credibility within the fire community. And nowadays, we lose more firefighters to suicide than we do to the fires because of the back-to-back rapid deployment cycles that they're facing. And Southern California,
as well as lung damage, a lot of them are dying of cancer because of all the exposure to repeated, really large fires and all of the chemicals and all of the smoke.
That's exactly right. And they're having to fight those things out. And the threshold for them proving that their cancers are related to the fires are too high. So that's a separate issue that I'm very supportive of. So, you know, and it also affects our senior citizens, right? So as every year our winters get colder and our summers get hotter, particularly our summers in a state that really wasn't built to have air conditioning. You know, Southern California in particular, mm-hmm. San Diego, a lot of our homes don't have air conditioning because it was never hot enough to need that here. And so we have senior citizens who it becomes a life or death issue. So as far as the common sense, you know, solutions go, I think that, you know, these things have to be prioritized as commitments to our communities. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, to your point of who's carrying the burden, corporations have to pay their fair share. We are the fifth largest economy in the world, last time I checked, and corporations are just not paying their fair share. I mean, in fact, for a while, they weren't even reporting what their carbon emissions were. I think that the Capitol just was successful in passing a law to ensure that. So, you know, I think that's where we start, and we go from there. I think there's a lot of things that we can do. Say again?
What about making sure that we retain the incentives for solar? We're seeing some efforts up in Sacramento to erode that by the utility companies right now, to erode the profits that a homeowner could make by selling their solar back to the grid, which of course is one of the big incentives for getting solar other than the altruistic motives.
Well, and that goes just right back to corporate greed, right? So the electric company is saying that they're not getting enough money for the power while they're also still shirking and ignoring their responsibility to the crumbling infrastructure of the power grid, which they refuse, just keep pushing off and off, saying it's too expensive while it gets more expensive. And, you know, that's another example of that is the oil and gas companies where we're seeing them having skyrocketing profits while gas is going up. So is gas going up because it needs to go up or because we're allowing these companies to continue to run us dry?
Yeah. On another issue, Joseph, you've been a champion for equality, having, as we mentioned earlier, won your own hard-fought battle to end discrimination in the military against LGBTQ soldiers. I wonder how that experience has impacted your life and your goal of fighting for equal rights for everybody in an era when, as you mentioned, we're seeing a rise in hate groups, including right here in East County, where we've seen, you know, attacks and discrimination on not only people in the gay community, but also Jews, Black people, Asians, Latinos, and immigrants, just to name a few, within the last couple of years here, synagogues defaced, you know. What's your take on that?
My take is that, you know, first and foremost, what drives me absolutely nuts is the inability of people who are in positions of leadership being unable to condemn these actions, right? It is the absolute bare minimum that these so-called leaders could do. And for political reasons, which if you start digging into that, why would you think there would be political backlash for you to denounce neo-Nazism or radicalization? That should be equally alarming. So anyhow, that's where it starts, right? And obviously that's something that I'm not afraid to do. When we met, I think I hadn't done it yet, but I was close to having taken a national stage in fighting for equal rights for LGBTQ plus service members. And that was on a national stage. It was post a George Bush administration. And a chairman of the Joint Chiefs that had said that homosexuality was immoral. So, you know, I was 10 years younger, had no team, and was exposed to the wrath of the darkest, you know, parts of the internet for quite some time.
So you've experienced that sort of being a target of hate speech, right? And probably threats yourself.
Exactly. So 10 years later, and now with a team, having been a Marine Corps officer and all of that, I'll tell you, you know, skin as thick as a rhino. We have had numerous death threats in the congressional here in the district. Nothing has or will stop me from, my commitment and dedication to service in the community. And that extends to everyone, because it's when these things occur to you, it doesn't make you try to find people like you to protect you and them. It builds your empathy towards any shared experience with other communities. So, you know, we've seen this hate towards the Arab community, the Muslim community, Jewish community. This district has picked up a large API community, which due to the previous leadership at the highest levels, the way that they racialized and mishandled COVID created more hate within or against the Asian community.
Yeah, and disabled people, we should mention. There's even been, you know, hate, even the past president mocking a disabled reporter. Shocking, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, I think you can't make up for lived experience. This is something that I've shown, you know, I have experienced the darkest sides of this. It is something that I am passionate about and I've dedicated my life to. And I would love to put that spirit and that fight to the service of this community in the Capitol.
Okay. And protecting the rights of everyone. As we do this interview, we are still in a global pandemic due to COVID-19 with yet another surge of a new variant, Omicron. There's been a lot of controversy over just how far the state should go with things like vaccine mandates, mask mandates, protecting public health against personal freedoms. There's also been controversies about, you know, shutdowns of business, how many, how long, which obviously shutdowns probably saved lives, but also caused economic harm to a lot of mom and pop businesses and even some larger companies. So I would like to ask Joseph, what are your views about how best to balance those competing needs, if they should be balanced, and how you believe we should be addressing the pandemic and any new needs that the pandemic itself may have created?
So I feel like we could spend an hour on this at minimum, yeah. Right? But briefly, you know, my brain is firing off in a million different directions. I think that...
Yeah, apologies. It was kind of a complex question.
But. No, that's quite all right. And I, you know, it's something that I'm excited to address. So I think that first and foremost, we've learned a lot of lessons from the pandemic. And I think it's important to carry those on with us and not to forget them. I think it's also important to evolve with the pandemic. So restrictions that were put in place 2 years ago now may not be practical 2 years later based on the new variant that we're dealing with.
Right. Plus we have vaccines and things we didn't have, tools we didn't have in the very
beginning. That's exactly right.
At least can help fight it.
Yeah. And something, you know, I think that we have to really keep an eye on is, again, back to the radicalization, this faction's very keen ability to find stress and then direct it in ways that divide us, right? So the politicization, difficult word, of the pandemic has been mm-hmm. very disheartening, right? It really should yeah. have been a 9/11 where we really come together as a country to lift each other out of this very difficult time. And unfortunately, you know, due to certain forces, it was manipulated just to divide us further. But I think the good thing that we've seen out of these challenges in the last 2 years is that it's brought attention to things that we had been either willfully ignoring or ignorant to. And that's a lot of the struggles of our underserved and underrepresented populations, working class people, things like paid sick leave, things like childcare, yeah. things like...
so important.
Yeah.
Technology in the home for school kids who suddenly are you know, had to study at home quite often.
Exactly right. Broadband, internet. And I keep thinking there's something that keeps escaping my mind, but, you know, access to healthcare and who is an essential worker, right? And that's something I'm very, very glad of is that finally... You know, grocery store workers and nurses and teachers are getting their day. But you know, sending a tweet out or saying that, again, it goes back to the firefighter things that I mentioned earlier. It's like saying you support these communities, but doing absolutely nothing legislatively in the Capitol to ensure that they receive the protections and dignity that they deserve is not enough. And so that's something that I, you know, is very important to me.
Okay. Speaking of healthcare, which is, of course, so important. A bill that would have provided universal health care for all Californians died yesterday. You know, the show is taped, but yesterday as we're taping it, without coming to a vote in the full assembly up in Sacramento after the author had to withdraw it because there was not quite enough support for passage. So I would like to ask Joseph, do you think that health care for all Californians is a goal we should work toward? And if so, is it affordable? It goes to, I guess, both, you know, is it a good idea? And is it something that is practical economically?
So again, on this one, I would lean on experts and scientists and doctors in the community. However, you know, broadly speaking, you know, it is a part of our democratic platform that healthcare is a universal right. And so working towards that goal, I think, is important. And I think it's exciting and encouraging that we saw such a bold attempt here. You know, I think that's something that's very important. When we see the surplus that we have in our as a state, but we see continue to live with these issues, faith is being lost in our system. And so we have to take more bold actions. Piecemealing things is just not moving fast enough. We need to take more bold actions to show the results to the state so that the state can continue trusting us. You know, it's a relationship, and that's very important. So I think that this is encouraging and that we will see more proposals on how to increase access to and make healthcare affordable in the state. And, you know, there's things that while this is dead for now, I hope that we prioritize other things rapidly, such as, you know, decreasing the cost of prescription medications in the state for our seniors and our low-income people. So I think we're headed in the right direction. I think there were too many questions. Again, as we talked about with COVID and other policies, such as housing, I hope that we learn from where we fell short so that we can come back with a more perfect product in the future. You know, there were a lot of questions as to where the revenue was going to come for this bill, whether people were going to be able to stay on their private healthcare if they wanted to, and whether the state had the infrastructure and the staffing, which is something that is endlessly frustrating to me as a, you know, a service member, someone who's been in the federal government system. When you see big systems that implement programs but don't have the staffing and resources to actually do them effectively. So did we or do we have, or what are we doing to create a infrastructure, a human infrastructure, prepared to take on a single payer statewide system?
Yeah, staffing in the middle of the pandemic is an issue. It seems like in every industry. I just went through it with trying to get emergency care for my dog, and you can't get appointments anywhere for weeks. You know, it's just affecting, it seems like, every aspect of our lives right now. So maybe it was just a particularly difficult year to try to get this through, but perhaps in the future that would be different.
I'm sorry to hear about your pet. But you know, that, so that goes to, you know, something we focus on a lot as service members is second and third order effects, right? Mm-hmm. We like to say good intentions, bad idea. It is very important to me, particularly as a legislator, if I'm so lucky to serve as, is that we're not creating more problems than we're solving just to, you know, have, you know, an exciting legislative piece that we can put our name to and say we did a thing, right? We have
right. The devil's in the details, basically.
Exactly right.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that on a day when we're all talking about whether or not we could have afforded a universal health care bill or not, your opponent, State Senator Brian Jones, came out with a video that he sent out to all of his constituents this morning, arguing that the budget surplus should be divided up and $1,125 should just be sent to every Californian. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, he represents a party that just allowed the child tax credit, which is $600 a month, to expire, and that we are now seeing is crippling.
At the federal level, we should clarify.
Right.
But yeah.
Right. Is causing much distress within families. I'm not entirely sure how he thinks that $1,100 is going to solve institutional shortfalls of the state. I think it's just one more way to take the easy way out when faced with very difficult issues.
There you go. What else would you like our readers to know about you and your candidacy for the 40th State Senate District that I maybe haven't asked, Joseph? And can you tell readers where they can find more information on your candidacy? And by the way, viewers, listeners, if you are tuning in late, we are speaking with Joseph Rocha, who is a Democratic candidate running in the newly redrawn 40th State Senate District, currently represented by Brian Jones, but it's shifting westward, so it's going to have less of East County and more of the coastal communities, as well as portions of North County.
Yeah, so readers or listeners.
It's all of them, really. It'll be on our website, on our radio show. We'll have a video posted online, too.
Exactly. So you all can learn more, hopefully, you know, join in, learn more, support us at rochaforsenate.com, R-O-C-H-A for Senate.com. You know, again, we've been talking a lot just about empathy and lived experience, and I think that those are things that you can't make up for. I've dedicated my life to service. I've gone through some tremendously difficult challenges and emerged stronger for it. I'm very proud of them. And I'm not afraid of anything. And I don't let things get in my way of helping my community. So you know, something we do have a more moderate conservative base here in our district. I've lived in and thrived in conservative spaces all my life, having just left the Marine Corps as a captain and a prosecutor. You know, I am a member of the VFW and the American Legion here, and I'll just say a certain someone came up to me and he said, do you know how some of the older vets refer to you here? And I was like, no, how? And I wasn't entirely sure. And I just kind of held my breath. And they say about you, he might be a Democrat, but he's a Marine. And that's the confidence that we have built over the past 7 months on our campaign in the district, where we've led with common sense, we've led with unity, we've led with focusing on the kitchen table issues. How do we help you provide for your family? Where are the services falling short of helping you get ahead? And I think that you know, we've seen it really resonate. Our district covers Miramar, which I would be tremendously proud to represent and make sure that the sailors and Marines and employees there have everything they need from the state to succeed. You know, we have fantastic universities and community colleges, which I was lucky enough to attend our community college and our university systems here in the region. And so, I invite people along. This is a textbook battleground race now, right? So it's a even registration, Republican, Democrat, with a large independent population that leans Democrats. And my task is to go out there, prove myself, earn that trust. And I'm confident that I can do that. And I think it would go a long way for this region to elect a Latino LGBTQ+ veteran of the Navy and the Marine Corps. In our region, our state, and in our country, I think this is the future of the Democratic Party. We cannot be the party of major cities on the coast. We have to start showing our ability to lead and serve in spaces that are more moderate and conservative, and change what people think of as Democratic leadership.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joseph, for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
This is the Public News Service Daily Newscast, March 7th, 2022. I'm Gina Tempesta. Another blow to the Russian economy. Visa, MasterCard, and American Express all said that they are suspending operations in the country. Meanwhile, there's some relief for the 30,000 Ukrainians temporarily living in the United States, as they've been granted temporary protective status for the next 18 months. But Ukrainian refugees here are worried about their relatives in the country.
The family petitions require a processing at a U.S. embassy, and the U.S. embassy in Ukraine is closed. But it will take a long time. I mean, the Ukrainian has to successfully flee and then get in touch with relatives here. The paperwork has to be filed. It's a very, very long process.
That's Catherine Miller Wilson of Hyas, Pennsylvania, a nonprofit that serves both refugees and immigrants. With declining COVID numbers and lifting mask requirements, doctors say recovery itself can be challenging. More from Eric Tigatoff.
Dr. Trenton James, a psychiatrist for Kaiser Permanente in Seattle, says stress, fear, and exhaustion are normal responses to this health crisis. He says people shouldn't ignore the strain the pandemic has put on mental health and can take care of themselves in other ways to help alleviate that stress.
Identify good self-care routines and stick to them. You know, I often encourage my patients to be kind to yourself and focus on the basics, like going for daily walks, even being able to go outside and enjoy the sunshine when we do get it, and breathing in fresh air.
The CDC also has revised its recommendations, saying people who aren't in counties with high transmission rates can go without masks.
Oregon is addressing the nursing shortage by licensing students to perform certain tasks in a hospital.
That licensure is really going to help nursing students who need to get a place where they can practice their skills while they're in school, give them an opportunity to make money and support their education.
Jenna Bitten, who heads the Oregon Center for Nursing, says COVID-19 exacerbated the already existing nursing shortage. Similar to other problems, a new survey now shows that more than half the students at the nation's historically black colleges and universities experience food insecurity in the last 30 days. Lily Bolke reports.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Russia's reckless operation around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant risked a catastrophe, a nuclear incident.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke for many nations when warning about fighting around Ukraine's nuclear plants. Russia seized Europe's largest nuclear power station last week. At an Emergency Security Council meeting Friday, UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield called that, quote, incredibly reckless.
And it threatened the safety of civilians across Russia, Ukraine, and Europe.
Thomas-Greenfield urged Russia to withdraw from the plant, allow medical treatment for injured personnel, and permit full access to the site. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held a virtual meeting Saturday with 300 members of Congress as lawmakers consider a White House request for $6.4 billion in aid. A ban on Russian oil imports is on the table. The U.S. may also provide replacements for Polish Soviet-era fighter jets that nation might send to its neighbor. The House passed a bipartisan resolution of support for Ukraine Friday. Representative Gregory Meeks, a New York Democrat and chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, introduced the measure.
Vladimir Putin has launched an unjustifiable, senseless war on a peaceful, sovereign nation.
Reuters reports at least 9,000 people have died from the violence and roughly 1.5 million people have been displaced. As the U.S. considers banning Russian oil imports, AAA reports prices at the pump have hit their highest point in over a decade, clocking in at just over $4 a gallon on average. In Wisconsin, the legislature's Republican leadership is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review that state's redistricting battle. The move comes after the Wisconsin Supreme Court approved a voting map submitted by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. That map would shrink, but not eliminate, the GOP's control of the legislature. Deborah Cronmiller with the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin says the Evers map is a bittersweet victory, since the state court previously ruled any new map would need to closely adhere to the state's current one.
Using the least change approach meant all of us who submitted maps for consideration were kind of boxed into a map that would retain certain amount of partisan gerrymander.
According to the Poynter Institute, Wisconsin's current voting lines are some of the most gerrymandered in the nation. They were drawn behind closed doors in 2011 and adopted when the GOP controlled both the legislature and governor's seat. The Florida State Senate has approved a measure establishing a new election crimes agency. According to the New York Times, it would be the first such state agency if approved by the House and Governor Ron DeSantis. According to the Associated Press, vote fraud is extremely rare. The AP confirmed fewer than 500 potential fraud cases out of 25 million ballots cast across six states, not including Florida. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.